The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. The court is at a little less than full strength this morning, but we have three matters on our oral submission docket. The first is 3497 Romero versus KPH Consolidation Incorporated from Harris County and the 14th District. Then is 3209 Geodyne Energy Income Production Partnership, IE and others, against the Newton Corporation from Dallas County and the 5th District. And finally, 4176 In Re Living Centers of Texas Incorporated, a petition for mandamus. The court has allotted 20 minutes of argument for each side in each case, and we'll take a brief recess between each case that's argued. Then we will finish the argument before recess for lunch. Recording is being made of the arguments this morning and is available for purchase in the clerk's office for a nominal fee. We're ready to hear argument in the first case, 3497, Romero against KPH Consolidation. Justice Smith is recused and Justice Brister is recused. I doubt Justice Schneider will have a chance to participate. Of course, the chief's position is vacant at this point.
May it please the court, Ms. Jennifer Hogan will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Jennifer Hogan, and I represent the petitioners in this case, the Romero family. This is an exceptional case, and it is exceptional for two reasons. First, contrary to the hospital's position in this case, the legislature has not immunized hospitals from credentialing claims. Malice is a high hurdle, but the Romeros cleared it, and they cleared it with clear and convincing evidence. The second issue in this case, the charge issue, goes away, actually, if the court agrees with us that the Romeros have established with legally sufficient evidence their malicious credentialing claim. But the Court of Appeals' opinion in this case, in which it reverses a separately submitted and unchallenged separate theory of liability because it reversed on no evidence grounds a completely different separately submitted theory is unprecedented. And it greatly complicates charge practice in Texas, and it upsets the very careful balance that this court has to this point struck between error preservation in the trial courts and review of jury verdicts at the appellate court level. Because malice is dispositive of this case, and because we proved it, that's where I would like to start this morning. Malice, I think we're all familiar with the standard that was submitted in this jury charge. The standard definition required basically proof of three elements: an objective risk element, a subjective awareness element, and a conscious indifference element. On the objective risk side, Dr. Baker, who was the surgeon who the hospital gave credentials to and allowed to perform this surgery on Mr. Romero, Dr. Baker is and was an admitted drug addict.
Is objective risk even an issue here?
I would think not, Your Honor. I hope that the court would agree with us on that, and particularly given the direct evidence that's in the record, we don't think it should be. The man is a drug addict. His wife testified so. Two of his office managers testified so. We've got his drug records in evidence. I can't imagine that there's anything less than legally sufficient evidence under any standard of his drug addiction. The second prong is subjective awareness. And again, This is not a case that is in any way built up on speculation, piling up of inferences. This is a one inference case on subjective awareness. The one inference that we want, that we ask the jury to make, is an inference that the hospital did what the hospital's director of quality assurance testified that the hospital was required to do and would do, and by the same token, that the hospital did what the hospital's credentialing expert that the hospital brought to trial, that the hospital did what that expert said that the hospital was required to do and would do, and that the expert assumed the hospital would do. That's the only inference we need, that the hospital did what its employee and its expert said the hospital would do.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals agree with you on that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals agreed with us, and that the only thing the Court of Appeals disagreed with us on was conscious indifference.
Right.
The hospital has taken the position in its brief before this court. It doesn't really support the Court of Appeals opinion on conscious indifference. It backs up and returns and wanted to argue objective and subjective prongs again, which is the position they took in the Court of Appeals. There was really the hospital never made at the Court of Appeals level the argument that the Court of Appeals accepted and wrote on, which is that given objective awareness and objective risk and subjective awareness, that nonetheless there was no evidence of conscious indifference. So it was somewhat surprising to us to see that as a result. But we think that that was a mistake that the court made.
But coming to conscious indifference, I'm looking at page 23 of your brief, and you say Romero's proved that the hospital allowed a known drug addict to perform elective surgery, did not suspend him, did not restrict his credentials. See pages 9 to 12 above. And I think that's true. And then you say they also offered evidence about a variety of actions the hospital could have taken to mitigate this risk, and they proved that the hospital chose not to take such actions, and you have the citation there. And then you say, considered alone, this is at least some evidence of the hospital's conscious indifference. And what I'm wondering is, why don't you need some evidence that the hospital should have done one of the things that you say they could have done?
Well, we do have evidence that the hospital should have. I mean, we have evidence that the hospital should have suspended Romero. We have that evidence from that they should have terminated his credentials. We have that evidence from our expert, Dr. Eichhorn.
Right.
Pardon me?
Right. The
right.
Court of Appeals cites that. Eichhorn's testimony in the hospital should have suspended Baker before the surgery was based not only on the drug abuse but also on the Chavez surgery.
And that's simply incorrect, Your Honor. I mean, that's not the way the record reads in any sense. Dr. Eichhorn and his testimony is in volume 6 of the record. But Dr. Eichhorn, let me read it to you. I mean, first he was asked the question on page 72 of volume 6. Are there steps that the committees can take in order to determine, A, whether suspension should take place, or B, whether some kind of testing should take place? Answer, yes, definitely. None of this is predicated on, not objected to, this all comes through this way. And what should have been done in this case? And he talks about there are several parts to it. The classic components is called a confrontation. He should have been given an immediate drug test, random, unannounced blood and urine tests. And the other part is the investigation, and that includes investigating other institutions. And that the drug testing should be supervised, absolutely. On page 73 of the record, Dr. Eichhorn is asked, was Dr. Baker still on the staff at the time of the Romero surgery? Answer, yes, definitely, obviously. He operated that day. Question, he had been suspended from Cleveland a couple of months before. Answer, yes, he had. Question, is that what Kingwood should have done in this case? Answer, yes, definitely. I mean, there's no doubt that our expert said that the man should have been suspended. There's other evidence from Eichhorn. He talks about what happened with other people who he was involved with, other doctors who were impaired, and what, you know, how they were confronted, how they were suspended, how they were terminated, how they were sent to counseling, and then they were slowly brought back in. So
I'll be clear. There's no question you need, with respect to the passage that I just read from your brief, you need evidence that the hospital should have done something that they didn't do.
Yes, I mean, I think that you can have that. I think you can have an inference, right? I think that, that this jury is allowed to determine from the evidence that it hears that you have a drug-addicted surgeon and that that poses an extreme risk and that the hospital has knowledge of it. I think the jury can conclude that by him being there that day and operating, that they don't have to have someone tell them directly. That's a bad thing to do. I think the jury can conclude from what it has heard about the way credentialing works, about what that a doctor has to be credentialed. He can't be there without the hospital's permission and allowing him to perform this particular surgery.
Well, the Court of Appeals says that Dr. Eichhorn testified that the hospital committee should take various steps, confront, do drug testing, conduct an investigation, and so on. And then there might be monitoring and education and restrictions and counseling and termination. And in the brief, you yourselves argued that maybe another doctor should have been present. But how can the jury know whether the doctor should have been in the operating room that day without some direct, without some evidence of that? I mean, it seems to me you need that. And you say you have it, but it just seems to me you need it.
Well, I think we have it, if you want to say we need it. But I don't think that you need – I think this is a classic example of that there are – first of all, I want to back up and I want to say the Court of Appeals is also slightly wrong when it talks about what that testimony is. And the court can read that in the record too. Because there is general testimony in this record about not knowing anything about what the credentialing committee knew in this particular case. Let me just ask you, Dr. Eichhorn, and the hospital's expert, Dr. Bender, and most of this is coming from the hospital. And the questions are all phrased from a general perspective. What kinds of actions can hospital credentialing committees take? And not even restricted to drug abuse or drug-addicted doctors. And that's the way you get this whole litany of different actions that a committee can take. But it's always divorced from any sort of a factual scenario. No one in this offered any testimony that you could have a drug-addicted doctor and that you could know that you were dealing with a drug-addicted doctor and you could allow that guy to be in surgery, even with an assistant, even with monitoring, even with drug testing. There is none of that kind of testimony in this record that all, with dealing with the fact of a known drug abuser, you can do anything other than terminate his privileges.
Well,
but
then I'm puzzled. You say in page 9 of the brief, you fault the hospital for not requiring another surgeon to be present to monitor and take over when necessary.
Well, we go on, right? I'm dealing with what the Court of Appeals says and what the Court of Appeals even ignores about the additional kinds of facts that we have. Because if you want to credit this testimony that when you have someone who's accused of drug abuse, that there are multiple steps that or things that you can consider, in that circumstance even, we go on and we say, look, if you want to look at that, if you want to credit that testimony, then look what we've got. We've got a guy who was not suspended. He was not terminated. His privileges were not restricted from keeping him from performing this surgery. And in addition to that, there's no suggestion that we know there was no other surgeon in the operating room with him. We know that the anesthesiologists weren't warned or told anything about this surgery. And we know that the Romeros weren't warned in any way by the hospital, despite their subjective awareness. So, frankly, we have an inference, if the court wants it, that they weren't drug testing him, because we know he was a drug addict. We've got plenty of that evidence. They couldn't have been drug testing him. They certainly couldn't have been drug testing him properly and not know that they're putting a drug addict in there. But I think all of that is just additional evidence. Do I think we have to have had it in order to have legally sufficient proof? No. But it is here, and it's something else for the court to be able to look at. I see that my opening time is up, and we didn't
reach that. You still got 4 or 5 minutes.
Well, we have the second issue, but I want to make sure that I cover the court's questions on the credentialing claim and on conscious indifference. I mean, I think that from a conscious indifference standpoint, the Court of Appeals suggested that we need to disprove any possible action that the hospital might have taken to deal with a drug-addicted doctor. And that's completely contrary to the way we've handled gross negligence or malice in past cases. We have come forward with proof of a drug addict who was allowed to perform surgery and couldn't perform surgery unless the hospital, with its subjective awareness, allowed him to do so.
Let me take you to the second issue. If the negligent credentialing claim should not have been submitted, then why isn't the way the case was submitted error? Assuming that it was preserved, and I'm trying to get past the waiver arguments, but assuming a good objection was made, what, isn't it error to submit invalid claim with a valid claim?
I don't think he did submit an invalid claim with a valid claim here. I mean, what the court has said in Castile and in Harris County is that you are going to submit Castile, especially where we started from. We accomplished that, and we did it because of Castile, right? There is a separate question that finds liability and causation on negligence, and the jury is specifically instructed, do not consider the conduct of the hospital in credentialing Dr. Baker in answering this question. Instead, consider only the conduct of the hospital and its nursing staff, Sawana Rubio, and its blood bank personnel. So there was a complete separation of those theories.
Well, assume that the Court of Appeals was correct and you lose on the credentialing claim. Then you have a negligence cause of action and a malice cause of action at the trial court, with one apportionment question for both separate theories of liability and one damages question for both two separate different theories of liability. If one of those two is found to be invalid, as was just asked, how can we tell if the jury based their apportionment decision and their damages decision on the proper theory, the one that was upheld, if one is upheld?
Well, I think this has to be – I don't think you can skip over waiver, but
well,
let's do it for a second. Because I think that what we've – first of all, damages. Let me try and get rid of that one quickly. There's no suggestion that the damages are different in this case because of the credentialing errors as opposed to the negligence errors. There's no evidence of any sort of separate damages that are caused between those two theories. Nobody ever said there was a divisible injury. This was submitted as an indivisible injury case.
But
I think the damages just has to go away.
But then let's talk
about apportionment because it's at least slightly different. I understand that the argument that's made is that, right, is that the Romeros argued that some portion of liability, of responsibility, ought to be placed on the hospital for its negligence and for its malicious credentialing. I don't think you can decide this case except from a policy standpoint. Do we want individual apportionment questions, and then how are we going to look at harm, or do we want multiple apportionment questions? We're going to have to submit apportionment questions in these cases, and we need to figure out how we're going to do it and how we're going to keep cases from being reversed. And I think the answer to that, for all the policy reasons that we set forth in our brief, are that individual apportionment questions are better, and that the burden ought to be on the complaining party to show harm, to show that the jury's 40% apportionment in this case to the hospital depends on the credentialing claim. And I don't think you can actually get there. If you look at what the Court of Appeals said, they said we argued that the jury ought to put responsibility on the hospital because of its malicious credentialing. And that's true. We told the jury to put 80% responsibility on the hospital for its malicious credentialing. The jury put 40% responsibility on the hospital. They put 40% responsibility on the doctor. If you look at the bulk of the evidence in this case, you're going to find a case that has a lot about credentialing, but it opens up and has a lot about the hospital's negligence in terms of its blood bank.
Well, let me jump in here. You kind of dismiss the question with regard to the damages issue. You don't think a jury's going to view damages differently if you prove negligence versus proving malice when they decide how much to assess in damages?
No, Your Honor, I don't, because I don't think it factors into the damages question at
you,
all.
You think a jury is going to view the damages question if malice is proven the same as if only negligence is proven?
Yes. I mean, I think when you sit as a court and you review the jury's evidence on damages, you never consider whether the liability theory is malice, or the liability theory is negligence, or the liability theory is products, a strict liability theory. I don't think that affects the damages question at all. The damages focuses on the injury to the people, and that's what we have to have evidence to support when we submit it to the jury and when we bring it back to this court. That's what you look at.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please support Mr. Russell McCann, present argument for the respondent.
May I please support? As indicated, I'm Russell with Mains, co-counsel for the respondent, KPH Columbia Kingwood Hospital, in this case.
Mr. Mains, are you advocating getting rid or saying there is no such thing as a negligent credentialing claim in Texas?
Well, actually, this court did that in Aguilar in terms of saying there's no such thing as a negligent credentialing claim.
Well, I mean malicious. Are you saying there is no such thing as a malicious credentialing claim?
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that there isn't a potential or possibility somewhere, but there
is. Tell me what that would
isn't.
Look like, if not this case.
Judge, I can't construct, in absent a waiver. The problem is that absent a waiver of the hospital privilege, of course, the hospital is imbued with a privilege, a peer privilege, for good legislative policy reasons, which this court recognized in Act 1, and which this court has continued throughout. The legislature has rejected any attempts at the modifications of Act 1 that the amicuses suggested were attempted in 2001. There is clear legislative intent of a malice requirement. Malice requires, by definition, conduct that is consciously indifferent. There is no evidence of any conduct in this case.
But my question is, with the privilege, you would never be able to get evidence of conduct. So, in effect, you're abolishing the malicious credentialing claim.
Well, first of all, the reason that the heightened element to malice from ordinary negligence was found justifiable in Admiral.
I'm not questioning the justifiability of the standard.
But
I'm just saying I don't see how you would ever meet it.
All I was getting ready to say, Your Honor, is that Justice Phillips made that observation, of course, in his dissent in Admiral, joined by only one other justice, that it would be virtually impossible to prove a malice claim under these circumstances. I'm not suggesting that it's impossible. I'm suggesting it wasn't done in this case, and that's all that we really need to do. There is no evidence of any proceeding by the committee. We do take contest with and do contest to some extent the Court of Appeals' reasoning in discussing subjective elements, because in essence there is an attempt there to impute knowledge or supposed knowledge by someone who specifically testified that he had no knowledge, and that's Dr. Kirk. It's really the only evidence there is in this record on which they rely, apart from their unbased opinion by Dr. Eichel. And that is that Dr. Kerr supposedly says that I was told by Dr. Parkinson that someone else had told him that there was a possibility of that he was using drugs. Now, what is undisputed in this record is that the Texas Board of Medical Examiners was reviewing these very issues during this credentialing process and had determined to dismiss any of those complaints after their investigation. We do know that, and that is undisputed in this record.
If you get as far as the Court of Appeals got, and I realize you don't think...
We do think they went too far in bending over to make it look like a harder case than it was.
But if you get as far as conscious indifference, the way the Court of Appeals does it, assuming that you can get that far.
Right.
Then isn't the only thing that the Court of Appeals found missing at that point was some evidence that the hospital should have done one of the other things that it could have done?
Well, of course, the question of should is invokes elements of negligence. The real, which is one of the real difficulties here. Basically, I view this notion that in the terms of the manner that it was submitted, kind of like a mandamus case. And that is that if there's discretion of a trial court to do two or three things, then you don't get a mandamus, because he must be required by law to do one thing. In this case, there was only the submission of the initial retention, the initial hiring, and the retention, which means that basically that he hadn't been fired. That they had to show that was the only available option, that his privileges be summarily suspended prior to this surgery. None of their evidence is very much time-related either, for that matter. It's very nebulous.
That's my question about. I'm having trouble with the timing here. It's not evident to me from the briefs. Is it correct that Dr. Kerr was told by someone that they suspected him of the doctor of drug abuse in 94?
Yes, that was Dr. Parkinson, and Dr. Parkinson then took that report and with it, after a suggestion from or after a conversation with Dr. Kerr, then reported that to the Texas Board of Medical Examiners, who conducted their own review process, and which was finalized and found to be no basis for it prior to this surgery.
But that was, he was granted active privileges in 96 and provisional privileges in
94. Provisional privileges
so
were granted in 94. There is no indication in the record whether this was before the attempt or after provisional privileges already.
But it was 94, 95. Is that clear from the record?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? This was in 94?
This was in 94, I believe, when Dr. Parkinson reported this to Dr.
And when was the medical boards? When did they close?
That happened in 96.
Okay.
And it was after that, I believe, that he was afforded the full privileges.
On page 15 of the petitioner's reply brief on the merits, they have some bullet points that if the hospital had investigated, and they go through a number of these, for example, that the office manager testified that she had seen Dr. Baker take hundreds of Vicodin. What was the time frame of these bullet points that they list? Had the hospital investigated?
Again, I believe that it is. It was their report to Dr. Parkinson, who is not a member of the Kingwood Hospital incident. It was her report to Dr. Parkinson that we're talking about. So it was after, in my judgment, and I understand the record, after the initial hiring and before the giving of regular credentials.
Okay, when did Dr. Baker admit that he had a serious problem and had gone through treatment that was not successful? When did all that occur?
Well, the admission and what is basically after this case had already been prosecuted or was in the process of being prosecuted. There was no evidence that that had ever been admitted to the hospital or that anybody at the hospital knew. Dr. Kerr specifically testified that he did not have any hard evidence of either incompetence of the doctor or that he was a drug abuser.
When did Dr. Baker?
Only that he had had hearsay evidence. And if he had any hard evidence, he said he would have taken it to the Board of Medical Examiners, and he didn't.
When did specifically Dr. Baker enroll in a drug counseling program that his office manager attended some of his counseling sessions? When did all of that happen?
I honestly don't recollect in terms of dates. I can supply that to the court if the court finds it necessary. But, again, all of those records were confidential and were not disclosed to the hospital either, because they're drug records. There's no indication whatsoever, no evidence that any of that information ever came to the hospital. The only attempted evidence of knowledge of Kingwood, of any kind of drug association with Dr. Baker, is from Dr. Kerr.
So they say in their reply brief that had you made the investigation, you would have learned, and then they list these things.
And that's a negligence question. And that's the problem, is that in trying to basically say, well, you should have done this, or they might have done this, or they could have done this, they don't know whether they did it or not. They don't know what they found or didn't. They don't know whether or not there were various options that were pursued. They don't know whether there were any limitations involved. They don't know anything about any action of the hospital committee because of the assertion of the peer privilege, which there can be no inference under the rules.
If we get over the inference hurdle for the moment,
sure.
That your expert said the hospital would have conducted an investigation and would have looked at this.
If it had not. And that's the hypothetical that they proposed.
There apparently is evidence that Dr. Kerr knew and that he was obligated to take that somewhere.
Again.
And that would have triggered an investigation.
That was done by way of a hypothetical, once again. Assume, as they were talking, questioning Dr. Binder, that Dr. Kerr knew. Dr. Kerr specifically testified he didn't know. He said he had heard, and that if he had any hard evidence, he would have taken it to the board. It was taken to the board, but not by Dr. Kerr, but by a different party from a different hospital, that's Dr. Parkinson. The board investigated that and cleared Dr. Baker. The evidence of that clearing and the hospital's knowledge of that clearing is in the record and is undisputed.
And when was he cleared?
He was cleared in 96. So all I'm saying, and then you couple that with the little leap in faith that is made with regards to the relationship of this alleged dangerous surgeon going around town operating on people when he's drug addicted, is the causation factor. Because the only evidence or suggestion that there is any drug impact on the actual surgical procedures being performed by Dr. Baker is a conclusion drawn by Dr. Eichhorn in interpreting deposition testimony that was made of some of the people in the staff who simply said that Dr. Baker did not appear to understand exactly why there was so much bleeding going on. Everybody who was in the surgery specifically testified that he did not look impaired, he did not act impaired, he did not act confused. He simply did not look like he understood why there was so much blood loss.
Is there, you don't seem to question that was malpractice. That was negligence on his part.
Well, of course, we don't represent Dr. Baker.
Right.
But
you don't seem to question that.
Well, we don't question that there's a connection between the blood loss and the damages. No.
Or that there's faulty judgment.
That Dr. Baker was negligent in some fashion in causing the blood loss. Well, the interesting thing about that, of course, is we don't question that as a practical matter, because, again, we're not appealing on behalf of Dr. Baker. But intriguingly enough, the argument that the call for additional blood had been made to the hospital in plenty of time to avoid any serious injury to the plaintiff as the alleged basis for their other negligence would indicate that the doctor had done what he was supposed to be doing and didn't get the blood products. I mean, their whole argument for some independent ground of negligence is based on the notion that he did exactly what he was supposed to be doing
and
when he perceived that there was too much blood loss.
And then the hospital, according to the briefs, took 45 minutes to get the blood there.
There is a dispute in the time.
Let me finish my question. It would have taken, according to the briefs, should have taken maybe 5 minutes to get it there.
There is some testimony from their people that it should have gotten there within 5 minutes or could have gotten there within 5 minutes. There's also testimony that within 45 minutes would have been okay from some of the defendants' experts.
Let me ask you about conscious indifference.
Yes, sir.
The objective prong on malice apparently was satisfied here, or at least the jury thought so. It's still a question.
Well, clearly the jury was charged, just like under Morreale, and yes, they did answer the question.
Apparently the jury thought that actual subjective awareness was satisfied, the second prong of the risk.
Correct. We disagree on both counts, but I
understand.
That's correct.
If those two facts are established, then why do you need more to establish conscious indifference? If, for example, I know that there's a very extreme risk of something bad happening, if I let Joe go in the room and do something. And I know it's an extreme risk, and I know that Joe is at risk if I let him go in the room and do it. Then I let Joe go in the room and do this, whatever it is, without stopping him. What more is needed to establish conscious indifference?
Well, the point is that you need to know what it is you did or didn't do. That is, there must be an act or omission. The entire notion of Morreale, as it's been incorporated into Chapter 41, as it was adopted by the court in Agbar with regards to its applicability to the malice definition in this type of an action, is that in order to make that link, you must have proceeded with conscious indifference. The jury was so charged. There is no evidence as to the timing of the knowledge, and that's why we disagree with the subjective determination in particular, that allegedly is imputed to the hospital. Again, the only real connection between the hospital and the alleged knowledge is the presence of Dr. Kirk, who was for a period of time chief of staff of the hospital. He was not chief of staff of the hospital when a lot of the indictments that he made and his conclusions about the competence of Dr. Baker were made before the hospital was even formed. In 1990.
They say that the hospital's expert on the credentialing process said that it was reasonable to assume that the hospital had obtained Dr. Baker's drug treatment records before they credentialed him. Is that accurate?
It's accurate to the extent that there, again, these are framed in the form of hypotheticals. Assuming that the doctor had answered these questions on the questionnaire and such, and assuming that they had access to this material, they assume that they would have done this investigation. And all we're saying is that there really isn't any evidence of what the proceedings were, what they entailed, either in the initial credentialing, which, of course, happened 4 years prior to this surgery, which is too remote in time to have any real causative effect anyway, operated successfully on substantial number of patients in between those periods of time.
But at some point in the credentialing process, somebody raised a question about did he have a drug addiction problem?
There's not only is there no direct evidence, we don't believe there's even a permissible inference to the effect that they knew he was a drug abuser. Whether or not there is some evidence to raise some inference that somebody ought to know something does not get you to the point of malice.
That's what I'm trying to get at. What was there any evidence that your expert, what did your expert say in context? After Dr. Kerr had heard the rumor, did your expert say, based on that, it's reasonable to assume they would have asked for and gotten his drug treatment?
Actually, what he said was that it was reasonable for him to because he was aware that Dr. Parkinson had reported it to the Texas Medical Board, and it was reasonable for them to await the outcome of the medical board's investigation. And that if he knew something else, if he had hard evidence, that he would have been obliged to take it to the board. And Dr. Kerr specifically denied that he ever had any hard evidence, and that he had not taken it either to the board or to any of the credentialing committee. There is no evidence that anybody ever made, or that any of these witnesses ever made any complaints or objections, or filed any statements with regards to any committee with the hospital.
How do we credit the wife's testimony that the hospital knew?
Because it's an abstract statement. She admits on cross-examination she never told them anything. She just said the hospital knew. That was just a conclusion on her part. This is an ex-wife, incidentally, of course. And there were various reasons for them to be at odds with one another that was indicated in the evidence. But that testimony is nothing but just a naked statement of, well, they knew. And without any basis whatsoever or foundation for any argument that they did in fact know. Now, particularly in light of the fact that this is a clear and convincing case, and in my judgment that the standard of appellate review is sufficient, it's heightened as a result of that, it's even more egregious to suggest that this is sufficient evidence to support the legally sufficiency of the malicious credential.
When the standard is clear and convincing, should the court, you know, when someone is attempting to prove the matter by inferences, should the court require the plaintiff to disprove some of the defendants?
I don't believe that was necessarily the effect of the, I believe, if I understand the gist of your Honor's question, of what the Court of Appeals was holding. I think really what they were saying is that if you can have multiple different conclusions as a result of the same piece of evidence, that particularly in a clear and convincing case, that's not enough to get you on down the road.
Well, I mean, let's say there's, and this is sort of because theoretical, but let's say there's some there's some evidence that the inference that would support liability is more likely than not. Okay, some evidence that will get you to that hurdle. But does it get you, you know, what do you need more to get you to the clear and convincing theory and clear and convincing evidence? And if it takes more, does that mean that the plaintiff has a higher or heightened burden at trial before the trier of fact?
Well, I do think that the plaintiff has a heightened burden at the trial with a clear and convincing standard.
To disprove the theory?
Not so much in terms of disproving things, but in terms of merely measuring the strength of the evidence, the strength of the inference necessary to rise to the level of being some evidence in light of the clear and convincing standard that produced a definite and firm conviction. And for instance, testimony of the wife in the abstract, hospital knew, would in my judgment never rise to that level. I don't think it rises even to the level under a regular legal sufficiency review, let alone under the heightened legal sufficiency review that I think is applicable in the clear and convincing case.
If there were evidence from which an inference could be made that the hospital did know about the drug problem, could you get malice just simply from the fact they didn't suspend privileges?
I don't believe so, and that's for the reasons that I indicated. Even their own experts said that there were various alternatives that could be taken, and that short of
but
suspension.
It's undisputed they weren't taken, correct?
No. It's not undisputed that they weren't, that none of these things were taken. It's undisputed that there's none proved in the record. There's none proved as to what the status of any investigation or complaints were made because of the fact of the assertion of the peer review privilege.
So again, back to my original question, there is no such thing as a malicious credentialing claim. I don't know how you can ever prove it if you can't find out this information and draw certain inferences from it?
Well, again, I think that, for instance, the nurse that claims that they had to testify that worked for the doctor outside the hospital, that takes a position, if she had made complaints, there would be evidence that there were complaints made. If there were numerous evidence of complaints independently that were made, that would at least indicate that there was knowledge or suspicion that genuinely could be imputed to the hospital.
That was my question. Let's just presume.
But that was not the case in this record.
I understand you're contesting that, but presuming there was evidence that would support an inference that the hospital knew, your position is it's still not enough for malicious credentialing. They didn't suspend his privileges.
That being the only alternative that they have under these circumstances, you have no choice but to fire this individual. Or suspending, terminating, whatever. That's your only alternative. I believe that that's not, that there's not a sufficient basis to do that. Since that's the only issue that was really before the court.
So you're just saying we can't infer that they didn't take alternative measures, but we can never know.
Not so long as the privilege is recognized, both by the statutes and by this court.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Let me ask you before I forget, regards the standard of review on appeal, and it's argued in the response and then in your reply, whether it should be elevated in a case in which the burden of proof at trial is clear and convincing evidence. I take it your position is that if it is elevated, you still succeed.
Yes, Robert, all right. That's definitely our position. So I wouldn't want to spend
You're
too much time.
You're not going to throw in the towel on that one.
No. I'm not going to throw in the towel on that one. No, Your Honor. I want to touch briefly on our charge argument and the waiver issue, which I didn't get to mention, talk about in the opening. The court's questions to me, and of course what the Court of Appeals wrote in its opinion, suggest that what needed to have happened in this case and the way to alleviate the harm is to submit an apportionment question that doesn't include malice, that said a portion that took the jury's finding of the negligence and the first separately submitted issue and gave an apportionment question and said, now, among those people who you've decided were negligent, apportion responsibility and don't consider the hospital's credentialing activities in answering this apportionment question. The problem is that's exactly what the hospital rejected. The trial court specifically offered that question to the hospital. It's on the record. She said, that will cure your harm in your Castile complaint, that we're not going to be able to tell what the jury is doing with this apportionment question. And the hospital said, we don't want that question. I think that it's impossible to really come to terms with this case or the way a charge ought to be submitted. I mean, we can debate in the abstract whether it's a good idea to have multiple apportionment questions. And I think it becomes so granulated and the charge becomes so unwieldy that it makes no sense for us to go from a policy standpoint that direction. But assuming that there's a case in which it's feasible and practical, then surely the parties need to tell the trial court that. And they ought to tell the other side that, too, because the whole purpose of charge objections and error preservation is so that we can get it right in the trial court, so that we don't wind up here having to have the entirety of a case remanded. This could have been fixed in the trial court if the harm is that the damages questions had a single predication on the two issues, then all that needed to happen was an objection needed to be lodged to that and a suggestion that they be separated. That did not happen.
Ms. Hogan, at page 11 of the respondent's brief, they purport to quote part of the trial record here, and it's the hospital speaking, quote, in question number 3, the apportionment question, we object to the identification. There's some other language here. I'll get right to the point. Along with a negligence theory resulting in a single percentage inquiry, which could, skipping some more words here, make it impossible to determine that there was a legally legitimate basis upon which rendition of judgment could be had. Why is that not an objection to a single apportionment question?
Because what follows that statement is the court. I'd be glad to cure that for you,
Mr. Sheehy, Your Honor, we discussed this yesterday, and I think at the time I didn't want to sandbag the court. The court, now I understand you're making the objection, but you know, it is my belief that there ought to be two predicate questions, two causation questions, two question number three questions by the court. Mr. Sheehy, two percentage questions, the court, two percentage questions, and that would cure the problem. Mr. Sheehy, I understand the court's position. The court, okay. That's why, because we don't look. What
so the answer is to read the rest of the record?
Yes, read the rest of the record. Because they were offered it specifically and they rejected it. And this court has said, you know, we don't look at just one narrow little point in time and one little sentence that someone says in deciding whether error is preserved. We can go back in time and look to see whether someone apprised the court. We can go forward in time to see whether someone apprised the court. But you've got to read the entirety of this discussion to see that these guys rejected the very thing that would have corrected the problem.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. Court, please recess.
All right.